The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we will continue to with another article from on the theme of the March issue of Our State Magazine, Where We're From. Time permitting, I'll perhaps throw in another couple of tidbits. The article is entitled, The First Family of Mountain Music. Doc Watson's legendary flat-picking style helped define the sound of North Carolina, but he would have been the first to say that he was one link in a long tradition of folk and bluegrass. Raised in a musical home in Deep Gap, his influence branched out far beyond Watauga County, welcoming new generations of musicians into the fold. And there's a photo here on this page of an album called The Watson Family by Folkways Records, and a picture of Doc Watson from 1964 in Deep Gap. He was an icon of old-time music known the world over, but he never forgot the people who shaped him back home, many of whom were featured on the classic 1963 album, The Watson Family, as I just mentioned that photo. If it weren't for the cast of characters, the old house in the black and white photograph wouldn't be much to look at. Crowded together on the creaky plank front porch are 12 people from two Appalachian bloodlines, the Watsons and the Carltons, all gathered for an extended family snapshot. Some are standing and holding musical instruments. Others, mostly kids, are sitting and looking like they'd rather be anywhere else but here. Front and center among the children, just to the left of her brother Merle, is 11-year-old Nancy Watson, barefoot and wearing a plaid skirt and a white top. Nancy remembers that day at her family's home in the tiny Watauga county community of Deep Gap, as if it were yesterday. "I was making a funny face," she says with a chuckle, "'cause I didn't know what they were going to use that picture for the cover." The cover that Nancy, now 72, is referring to is an album called The Watson Family. Released in 1963, it's a survey of traditional ballads and fiddle tunes from northwestern North Carolina, an area that music scholar Ralph Rensler of the Smithsonian Institution once described as one of the richest repositories of folk song and lore in the southeastern United States. The adults in the photo include Nancy's maternal grandfather, Gaither Carlton, a well-known regional old-time fiddler since the 20s, her paternal grandmother, Annie Watson, and her mother, Rosalie Watson, both of whom possessed rich and honeyed mountain drawls that put the heartache in the family songs of struggle and faith, and Nancy's father, Arthel Lane Watson, whom everybody called Doc. Though he was loath to admit it, Doc Watson, blind from childhood, but with hands that could wire houses, saw wood, and play the guitar like nobody's business, would eventually rise above all the others. That's because when Doc put a flat pick to the strings of an acoustic guitar, he redefined the instrument's role in folk music. In his hands, the acoustic guitar was no longer just a rhythm instrument behind a fiddle player sawing out melodies. Doc picked out the melodies on the guitar itself and played them with lightning speed. Within a couple of years, Doc and Merle Watson would be performing rousing concerts to college students around the world and inspiring their fellow members of the American folk revival of the 1960s, from culture-shifting artists like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez to guitar whizzes like Clarence White and Tony Rice. Just past the Mountaineer Ruritan Clubhouse in the unincorporated town of Sugar Grove, Old U.S. Highway 421 splits off from the main road and winds north for about a mile. There on the left, about 20 minutes west of Deep Gap and 10 minutes east of the North Carolina-Tennessee line, a castle-like stone building, the old Cove Creek High School, rises majestically from a recess against a backdrop of rolling hills. Inside the Modest Life of the Watsons, the first family of North Carolina mountain music unfolds in rare photographs, woodworking equipment, patchwork quilts, and mostly vintage musical instruments, vinyl records, and awards. Scattered about the two-room Doc and Merle Watson Folk Art Museum, the exhibits, many of them anyway, come with labels lovingly and painstakingly handwritten by Nancy herself. There's a shot of Doc, Rosalie, and a teenage Merle sitting on a little country stage in folding chairs, guitars in hand, mid-performance, frozen in time. "I can tell what song Mama was singing in that photo," Nancy says, and then she pauses. "Oh, what's the name of it?" She began singing in a warm alto that conjures the voices of both her late mother and grandmother. The big courtroom was crowded when the judge said, "Guilty, son." She's recalling the words to the folk standard, "I Heard My Mother Weeping," a tragic ballad that appears on the album, The Doc Watson Family Tradition. "A lot of times," Nancy says, "there'll be a picture of Daddy or Merle or Mama performing, and I can just look at it, and I know what they're playing for some reason. I don't know how, but I do." There's the quilt stitched to the words, "My love is unceasing, I'll stand by your side, be your mother and friend," to Merle, 1975. Nancy remembers the Christmas nearly a half century ago when Rosalie made it. The pattern is from an embroidery sampler from the 1700s, she said. "We saw a picture of it in an early American Life magazine. Mama asked me if I could draw up the picture, said she wanted to make a quilt from it. And I said, 'Yeah, I'll draw it up for you.'" Then there's the pump organ that Nancy pined for when she was a little girl. It looks just like the one she remembered in her grandmother's house, the one her aunt would play while Nancy sat in her lap. Years later, Nancy's wish came true. Mom and Daddy had gone riding with some friends one weekend, and when they came down to Darby, about a half hour south of Deep Gap, and when they came back, they said, "We found your birthday present today." Said it was too big for us to get in the car, but they're going to bring it up here next week. Well, that next week, I heard a pickup backing up to my little apartment, which was in Mom and Daddy's basement. And when they unloaded that pump organ, I started to cry. When Nancy thinks about all the items she's donated to the Doc and Merle Watson Folk Art Museum, she doesn't just think about her celebrated father. She also thinks about her late mother and brother. She thinks about her aunts, uncles, and grandparents on both sides of her family. She thinks about the community of musicians who'd gather at the house to play and sing. You see, the Doc and Merle Watson Folk Art Museum isn't your typical institution dedicated to the singular accomplishments of just one music legend. And that's because Doc Watson wasn't your typical musical legend. Oh, he easily deserves a museum of his own. Not only did Doc create a style of flat picking that transformed the guitar into a lead instrument in an acoustic folk and bluegrass music, but he also had a warm and amiable baritone vocal style that made every member of an audience feel as if he were singing directly to them. And then, of course, there was his vast catalog of folk classics like Tennessee Stud, Deep River Blues, and Omi Wise. But Doc's legend is as intricately tied to his extended family as it is to his own extraordinary talents. In every respect, Doc Watson was part of a family. Family is what made him him, and family is what made this little rural museum and celebrates. Born on March 3, 1923, Arthel Watson grew up surrounded by music. His banjo-playing father, General Dixon Watson, led the singing at Mount Perrin Baptist Church in Stony Fork. Around the house, his mother sang hymns and regional folk ballads like Omi Wise, which Doc would later record for his own self-titled solo debut album of 1964. Early on, he'd shown a natural skill on the banjo, a talent that transferred over to the guitar when he began playing one as a teenager while attending the North Carolina School for the Blind and Deaf in Raleigh. By his 20s, he was performing for change on the streets of Boone and Lenore. At 24, he met and married Watauga County native Rosalie Carlton, whose father, Gaither, had a reputation across the region as a top-notch fiddler. who performed alongside fellow mountain music greats Clarence Ashley, G.B. Grayson, and Al Hopkins. In the early 50s, Doc picked up the electric guitar and played with rockabilly bands like the Country Gentlemen and the Carolina Buddies. And I'm telling you, Nancy says, he was good on that Les Paul guitar. You better believe it. He could beat any of those modern rock and roll guys all to pieces. Meanwhile, Rensler of the Smithsonian Institution had been traveling down to North Carolina to check out regional music scenes. In 1960, he saw Ashley perform at the Old Time Fiddlers Convention in Union Grove and offered him a recording session. Ashley chose Doc to accompany him on banjo and guitar. When Doc showed up with his electric guitar, Rensler encouraged him to use an acoustic instead. Doc agreed, but he performed his solos as if he were playing an electric, and the results sounded as much like those of black guitarists who played the Piedmont blues as they did Appalachian folk. Soon Rensler had Ashley and Doc performing at clubs like Gerd's Folk City in New York's Greenwich Village and at the celebrated Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island. Seeing Doc as the standout player, Rensler handed him a solo deal with Vanguard Records, the label of then-popular folk singers like Joan Baez, The Weavers, and Odetta. To Rensler, Doc brought a sense of an Appalachian authenticity to a label consisting largely of records by northern musicians who appreciated but didn't live mountain music. Doc's early performances got rave reviews, and his own down-home picking would influence countless singer-songwriters throughout the 60s. By then, Merle had begun performing alongside his dad, and their live shows, documented on albums like Doc Watson on Stage featuring Merle Watson, included fiery dueling fretwork that brought audiences to their feet. "I've sat on the side of stages while they were playing," Nancy remembers, "and I would see them things. Energy rise that happened between them and the audience. It was phenomenal. They just totally connected with one another. They gave to the audience, and the audience would give right back to them. They'd bring people up with a peppy song, make them happy and cheerful, and then play something really sad to make people's emotions back down. And then after a really sad song, they'd come back with something happy again. It was like an adventure. You didn't know how you were going to feel from song to song." But in 1985, tragedy struck. Merle was killed in a tractor accident about 2 weeks before he and his dad were scheduled to play at Wilkes Community College in North Wilkesboro. "Daddy was going to quit," Nancy says. "He just kept saying, 'I can't do it. I can't do it.' He just felt like he couldn't go on without my brother." A few nights later, Doc had a dream. He said it felt like he was stuck in mud and he couldn't get out, Nancy recalls. "And then Merle came, and he took Daddy by the hand, and he said, 'Come on, Dad, I'll help you. You can make it.'" Doc ended up playing the gig, and the crowd went wild. "The audience just honored Daddy's courage," Nancy says, "and it felt like from then on his music just took off. It just exploded. People everywhere started flocking to him. That's when I realized how huge he'd gotten." 3 years later, Doc launched Merlefest on the campus of Wilkes Community College, and since then, the event has served as one of the most important festivals featuring Americana music in the world. Countless artists, from the West Coast band Nickel Creek to North Carolina acts like the Avett Brothers and Carolina Chocolate Drops, got their start or got a boost in popularity by performing at Merlefest. Doc played at the festival every year until his final performance there on April 29th, 2012, exactly 1 month before he died. He was 89 years old. In the corner of one room of the museum at Cove Creek, sits an old wooden workbench that Doc built in 1953 and that he continued using until well into the 21st century. A hammer, an axe, and a carpenter's square sit atop the bench alongside a photo of Doc building an addition onto his family's home. Hanging on the wall behind the bench are two massive cross-cut saws that Nancy's grandfather taught Doc to use when he was a little boy. It's how Doc learned to be self-sufficient, even with his disability. It's also how Doc learned that individuals don't do things on their own. They do things as part of families, as communities. And this is why the Doc and Merle Watson Folk Art Museum is not just about Doc. Daddy didn't like being put on a pedestal, Nancy says. When people would do that, he'd say, "No, I ain't no different from you. I just happen to make my living as a musician." Looking back, though, she's aware that's not quite true. She pauses, and in a near whisper, as if someone is listening, perhaps her dad, she adds, "But you know, he did have an extraordinary gift." Now, let me go back and talk about the photos that are included with this article. There, the photo that Nancy was talking about earlier, inside the old photos of the Watsons, including one of Merle, Rosalie, and Doc, are interwoven like keepsakes, like a quilt that Rosalie made for Merle in 1975. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. So these photos are in the Old Cove Creek High School where the museum is. And so that shows a picture of the three of them sitting on stage, just like she described earlier, each with a guitar and mid-song. The quilt that she made for Merle, it says, "A tree of love, a tree of life, by Holy Spirits given, to help you through this world of strife and color your path to heaven." And it's a tree, so it's a white background with a red border, and then there's a tree with acorns, maybe other fruits on there, different colored, I would say they're acorns, but and different colored leaves through this tree, and that's what she made for Merle, to Merle, 1975, from Mother at Christmas. Through memorabilia and placards handwritten by Nancy Watson, the two-room Doc and Merle Watson Folk Art Museum paints an intimate portrait of the family that helped introduce the world to the music of Western North Carolina. And there's a couple of patrons looking over the exhibits. There's a piano in there, and there's the cross-cut saws on the wall, and music looks like a recording studio in there. A banjo and a banjo case, from what I can see in the photo here. Nancy Watson, pictured with her parents Rosalie and Doc, gave the museum a personal touch by sharing stories and memories behind items like Doc's early banjo. And it shows a picture of them on the sofa, a sweet family picture there. Doc's hands, lightning fast on a guitar, were just as skilled with an axe, a hammer, and a carpenter square. These tools are now on display at the museum, and tools that his father taught him to use as a boy. If you're interested in exploring more, you can listen to a curated playlist of Doc Watson's music at ourstate.com/doc-playlist. To learn more about the museum, which is open by appointment only, you would go to watsonfolkartmuseum.org. watsonfolkartmuseum.org. Okay, we're going to switch gears here and move to the roads and routes section of that. This section highlights unique destinations from the coast to the mountains, and this is called Stone Paradise. Dreams come in all shapes and sizes. In Caswell County, a man's aspirations took the form of a miniature rock and cement village. North Carolina Highway 86 may not be the road to heaven, but it's the road to Shangri-La. The north-south route slices through the heart of Caswell County, breezing into the small, unincorporated community of Prospect Hill before reaching Orange County. It's easy to miss if you don't know what you're looking for, but Prospect Hill is where you'll find Shangri-La. The brainchild of retired and now deceased tobacco farmer Henry L. Warren, Shangri-La is a miniature stone village of chest-high buildings fashioned from truckloads of white flint rock, quartz, red brick, cement, and Warren's whimsical imagination. The fantastical village, perched on a slope just off Highway 86 beside Warren's homestead, includes all kinds of structures from a farmhouse to a doghouse to an outhouse. There's a church, a hospital, a mill, a motel, a movie theater, a general store, a jail, a library, a city hall, even a liquor store. Pretty much everything you'd find in a real village. Some people call it White Rock Village, Warren once told a reporter. I named it Shangri-La. He borrowed Shangri-La from Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidential retreat of the same name, which later became Camp David. Before that, Shangri-La was a Tibetan paradise written about in James Hilton's 1933 novel, Lost Horizon. And that's what the term has come to mean in common language, a beautiful imaginary place of near perfection. Shangri-La certainly became Warren's paradise. Beginning in 1968 at age 75, the Caswell County native spent the last 9 years of his life creating the village, inspired by a miniature water wheel he'd spotted at a Hillsboro antiques shop. Day after day, Warren quarried the stone from his property and his neighbors, hauled it to the village, and methodically erected building after building, solidifying each structure with cement that he mixed himself. Like most farmers, you get used to working with your hands and you just want to do something when you retire, says Jillian Medlin, executive director of the Caswell County Chamber of Commerce, who grew up in the same community as Shangri-La. So from sunup to sundown, he would go out there and work on this little village of his. It began with a mill, but then the miller needed a house. Then he needed a place to buy food and a place to worship. Then he needed, well, you get the idea. As he built, Warren incorporated some quirky odds and ends to add to the village's appeal. The church's steeple, for example, is an inverted table leg, painted white. Other items scattered throughout the village, like hidden Easter eggs, include cast-off doorknobs, plumbing fittings, ceramic animals, and odd pieces of iron. At the entrance to Shangri-La, Warren placed his motto engraved in stone, "Let me live in a house by the side of the road and be a friend to man." The locals watched with curiosity as Warren labored alone in his growing village, consuming a bottomless supply of cigarettes and Coca-Cola. Eventually, folks went to see the village for themselves, and they marveled at Warren's creation. Children, in particular, have always enjoyed the unorthodox attraction. They revel in leaving behind toy figures to live in Shangri-La. Warren characteristically downplayed his obsession with the village. "It's just a hobby," he used to like to tell folks. "That's all it is." No, Shangri-La was, and still is, much, much more than that. When Warren died in 1977 at age 84, he left behind a North Carolina treasure, a timeless community that nearly half a century later continues to attract and inspire visitors from near and far. "We get folks calling all the time wanting to know when and how they can visit the place," Medlin says. "People still love to come and see this wonderful little village." Henry Warren would have loved hearing that. Some people spend their whole lives searching for their version of utopia, but Warren built and shared his. I'll go back through some of the pictures. It took Warren 9 years to create his Shangri-La. He incorporated discarded items like the inverted table leg for the church steeple into the village. And all of the creations there pretty much are white stone. There is some tan and off-white stone, but mostly white stone and cement and trimmed in red. And the picture of the church has, as he says, that steeple with the inverted table leg for the steeple made from the inverted table leg. Then we have a picture here. Let me read the caption. It says, starting in 1968 at age 75, Henry L. Warren created a stone village comprising 27 buildings. The attraction is free and open to the public. And so it's laid out. Again, it's all trimmed in red. It looks very similar to the church. all trimmed in red trim. And there's little gates, and there's a water tower in the village. And it shows a man to get sort of perspective. None of the buildings, except for the church, is going to be probably, I'd say, maybe 10 feet tall, maybe 12 feet tall with the steeple, at the top of the steeple. And the water tower is maybe, I don't know, 10 feet tall. Everything else is probably 6 feet and under. Maybe one other building that is that. But it's just very, very compact and just very creative. It's pretty amazing, actually. We've got time for one more short article, so I'll move to the house and home section. This section highlights interesting properties around the state. This one is called Pieces of Place. An artist takes inspiration from symbols of her city and landscapes across the state to craft stained glass pendants. Light catches the iridescent stained glass Moravian stars in artist Kel Mayo's hand. They're an emblem of Winston-Salem, where a group of German Protestants settled in the 18th century seeking religious freedom. When Mayo moved to the city in 2013 after living in Miami, Florida, she, too, found a sense of peace in her new home state. She keeps that feeling in mind as she fashions glass into the shape of North Carolina, the fuchsia figs she once saw growing on Ocracoke Island, and the emerald hummingbirds that flit outside her kitchen window. Mayo started her business, Camel City Glass, when her 8-year-old triplets were toddlers and she found herself craving a creative outlet. She'd grown up watching her own mother, also a stay-at-home mom, make stained glass in their garage. From her, Mayo learned the value of having a project of one's own while caring for others. Her mom handed down her old stained glass equipment, and Mayo put it to good use. While her children napped, she fell in love with the scratch of scoring glass and the sizzle of soldering metal. She uses a subtle color palette in her creations and sometimes incorporates intricate beadwork as a nod to her first job at a jewelry store. Her pieces, streaky blue seascapes, deep red flowers, leafy sprigs, bring the outside in and cast rainbows of light around the room. Many of her North Carolina-themed items, including cardinals and lighthouses, can be found in BL Makers Market in Thomasville. Just as Mayo watched her mother, her own kids watch her grind down jagged glass to make something beautiful, piece by piece. To learn more about this, visit CamelCityGlass.com. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.